Hi, Patrick.
My name is Dominic. I'm a big supporter. Thank you for the podcast. I'm calling today to talk briefly about the economy. Your listeners may have heard by now that the fourth quarter of 2018 is one of the worst economic quarters in history. In fact, for the U.S. market, it was the worst final quarter since the Great Depression years of the early 1930s. There's strong evidence for a devastating downturn in the near future. Every time the economy grows, the people at the top gain more power, while everyone else gets nothing. However, when the economy fails to grow, more middle-class people become poor, and the already poor are forced into more precarious and dangerous circumstances. And sure, there are many common-sense economic policies that could prevent an economic disaster this year. Increasing immigration, for example, is a sure way to continue economic growth. Higher taxes on the rich, intelligent trade policies, all of these things could be implemented easily to prevent a recession. But trying to continue economic growth is a doomed and pointless battle. The very concept is absurd on its face. All metrics of economic health are based not on the stability of the economy or the economy's ability to provide for people's needs. Instead, to be considered healthy, the economy must grow. The material well-being of billions depends on never-ending growth within a finite ecosystem. We all know the growth cannot continue forever. It's impossible. The economy has nothing to do with the means of survival. Not to say that the economy doesn't control life and death. Clearly it does. But what I mean is the things we need to survive, like meaningful relationships, food, shelter, medicine, these things are not destroyed when the economy fails to grow. There's no practical reason, other than our shared cultural mythology, that it should be any harder to survive when the economy shrinks. What I'm trying to do with this message is declare war on an idea. The so-called economy is not compatible with long-term survival. It's a scam. We need to fundamentally adjust our society's thinking, and I believe that change starts in our own minds. Of course, reality will not change overnight. We can still expect pay cuts and layoffs this year. We still need to band together and provide solidarity, just like always. All I'm asking is that we work to adjust our thinking in a way that tries to discard the idea that we need to give up things because of the economy. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks for your time.
Hey folks, thanks for tuning in to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. Before we get into this episode, I just want to thank Dominic for his message. Thank you for calling that phone number and leaving that really good message there. And you know, Dominic, if you are the Dominic that I believe you are a supporter of this project. So thank you so much for your support, Dominic. You have been, I think you were one of the very first to really donate a substantial monthly donation to this project through Patreon. So, Dominic, you've been with this project for quite a long time. So, thank you so much for your support. You know, basically, everything you said there at the beginning is absolutely true. And I 100% endorse everything you're saying. I don't really have anything to add or to contend with at all. You're 100% correct in saying that the stock market has seen historic dips, historic lows this past quarter. There's something that I guess maybe I would say is that it's just interesting how when the stock market is going the way that it has been going, it doesn't necessarily affect, at least immediately, it doesn't seem to affect the lives of average people. You know, when the stock market is doing this and I look around and I'm like, actually, people are still doing their thing, right? But it is an indication that the priesthood of finance is meeting certain ends, I would say, and the logic of that system is meeting its end. And we know why that's the case. You know, as you mentioned, we are a planet with finite resources. And the fact that we even call it resources is sort of an indication of our impoverishment of our imaginations, which is an indication, of course, of our culture, an indication of our socioeconomic system and what it has hoisted upon us as a people to think about the health of this planet, the health of the living systems of this planet in these terms. So yes, you're absolutely correct. And you know, because of what's coming, because of what's currently unfolding on this planet right now, We do need to build communities. We do need to build those networks. We do need to build a real robust network that exists outside of the dominant structures of the society. And also, and I would also contend, in considering what this episode is going to be about, before I get into that, it's not just about building alternatives. It's about also building robust defensive measures so that we can prepare for what the state and its allies are have in store for us, as it were, attempt to break away from that system, right? We need to be aware of that as well. But again, you know, all of this is coming down, so it's a matter of asking the right questions and building the skill sets required to navigate our way through it the best that we can. Which isn't to say that we're necessarily banking on an outcome, right? That we're banking on survival even. But it is worth fighting for, because as I've talked about, and I'm sure, Dominic, you've talked about plenty of times with your friends and your family and people that you care about as well, if this is all going down, we need to live as beautifully as possible in the time that we're in. And it's difficult, but we have to do it. It's imperative of us that we live accordingly. And that's something that I'm still trying to figure out in my own life. So, Dominic, thank you for the message there at the beginning. And if anybody else wants to send a message to this, to me, to this podcast, and I could play it at the beginning of the podcast, just like Dominic's message was played at the beginning, you can do so through this phone number. So you can go call 208-918-2837. That is 208-918-2837. You call that number, it'll take you straight to a voicemail message, and then you'll leave a message anywhere from, say, 30 seconds to 3 minutes. And if it's, you know, good, basically, if you have something that's really worth saying that I want to include in this podcast, I'll put it at the beginning of these episodes. So I've had some really great messages so far. Dominic is one of those. So thank you, Dominic, for that message. If you want to learn anything about this project, if you want to learn about what this project is about, and you want to have access to any of the various things that's connected with this project, just go to the website, lastborninthewilderness.com. You can find every episode that I've produced and released, every segment. You'll find all the various social media platforms that this podcast is updated regularly on. You'll also find a link to the newsletter. Also, I'll just mention this. All of these links that I'm mentioning are down in the description. So all those links are down there. They're on the website. But again, if you want to like subscribe to the newsletter, it's a new thing I've been trying where you can just stay updated with new episodes and other updates with this project. You can find a link to that down in the description and again on the website. Also, you'll find down in the description and on the website a link to the one-time donation page. That is through the PayPal link. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. And you can make a one-time donation through that link. Or you can go to the Patreon page. As I mentioned with Dominic, he is a patron. He's been supporting this project for months at this point, which I am very grateful for. But if you also want to participate in that, if you want to contribute to the production of this podcast, you can go to the Patreon page, which is patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And there you can make very small or whatever size donations you want monthly to this project. And on that page, if you are a patron, you'll gain early access to these interviews, these conversations before the official public release, and you'll find other extras on that page as well. So without any further delay, here's the episode. I speak with Peter Gelderloos. Peter is an anarchist originally from the United States, and as of the recording of this interview, he's now living in Spain. But he is an activist and a writer. He's somebody that's been at this for a long time. He's the author of quite a few books on anarchy, and the two books that we talk about the most in this podcast is his book, How Nonviolence Protects the State, and his most recent book, worshiping power, an anarchist view of early state formation. So we shift gears about halfway through this interview. So the very first half, we talk about how nonviolence protects the state. Now that title kind of gives you an indication of what the book is about. You know, Peter, he doesn't pull any punches in that book. I've been making my way through that book, and it is very well written. It is very good. And I think anybody who has any curiosity about tactics, about how to approach revolution, how to approach insurrection, how to approach building a more beautiful world that we know is possible, how we can do that by purely nonviolent means, that book attacks that notion. That book attacks that notion that nonviolence and pacifism itself is going to be enough in approaching what we truly desire, which is to dismantle oppression, to dismantle oppressive institutions, to dismantle the state, as it were, and capitalism. We cannot do this through merely nonviolent means. And what Peter really gets at, and especially in the beginning of this interview, is he unpacks this idea of what violence is, and he also gets into why we need to expand our understanding of what is actually useful and what actually works in bringing about significant change in the world. And he cites in that book, particularly in that book, all these various examples of how diversity of tactics really gets things done. You know, he's not saying like we shouldn't be nonviolent. He's just saying that when the time comes and when it's absolutely appropriate, which there are plenty of times in which it is, we need to not be so afraid of the idea that we can actively resist with violence against violent institutions, because the state itself is built on violence. The state itself, in order to maintain its legitimacy, uses the threat or violence itself in maintaining that status quo. And so we unpack some of his ideas, and we also get into his second book, Worshipping Power, an Anarchist View of Early State Formation. That title kind of gives you an indication of what that book is about as well. So in that one, he gets into more of how states have formed throughout human history, how it's not an inevitability that complex societies or, quote, advanced societies will adopt a state structure. I ask Peter to sort of unpack that. You know, what is a state from an anthropological perspective? What is a state? And are there examples of societies, and there are numerous examples of societies that don't, at least in the Western mind, linearly progress from pre-state to state to whatever, right? There are many societies that do adopt a state structure, but then abandon those structures because they see them as being destructive to the natural world, to their cultures, to the very identity in which these people have and their relationship with the land, right? So understanding that we can abandon the state. We don't have to abide by this logic that the state is the culmination of human progress, right? That itself is a mythology. And one thing that I want to comment on is that I'm really proud of myself and that I was able to get a hold of Peter. I had to kind of work my way. I had to sort of figure out the best path to find contact information for him. And you know, after several weeks of corresponding with him, we finally found a time. We found a way to communicate. But the thing is the sound quality isn't as good as it's good enough. I'll say that. And that is in great part because of my friend Jordan Thornquist, who he's helped out with the podcast numerous times. He was involved in the live podcast I did back in October. He's done an excellent job with this particular interview where I asked him to help with the sound quality from Peter's audio. And he really helped raise the voice out of the noise, so to speak. But there is still a lot of that noise in the background, and there are some spots that get a little patchy. So please bear with it. I do think that the interview itself and the message that Peter has in his books as well as in this interview is well worth listening to. So if you want to learn more about Peter, the best thing to do is to go down in the description. I'll have links to his books down there. His book, Worshipping Power, his most recent book was published in 2017, Worshipping Power, An Anarchist View of Early State Formation. You can find that at AK Press, so I'll provide a link to that. Also, his book, How Nonviolence Protects the State. There's several editions of that from different publishers, but the edition that I got is from a little publisher that I like to buy books through called Detritus Books. I've talked about them previously with an episode I had with John Zerzan, a few months back. They had a really beautiful edition called Time and Time Again of three of John Zerzan's essays. They just do a really beautiful job with those books. I'll provide links to those books down in the description. Please go buy those books, even if you don't agree with Peter's assertions in this interview and in those books. It is well worth looking into, because if you believe something, you should challenge those beliefs. And that is really important, especially in a time where people are becoming increasingly entrenched in their ideologies. And that is just about myself, as just about anyone else. So this isn't meant to be a criticism to anybody in particular. This is just a general statement. So Peter, thank you for having this interview, this conversation with me. I really hope we can do this again. And thank you all for listening to me ramble up to this point. Here is my interview with Peter Gelderloos. You know, your book, How Nonviolence Protects the State, has been discussed a lot, especially within, I would say, leftists, of course, and anarchist circles, because it brings up such important analysis. I know that the title, I know, How Nonviolence Protects the State, is rather provocative. But I think that conversation you bring up, or the debate you bring up, or the perspective you bring up, I should say, in that book, is still, again, being discussed to this day. And especially now, I mean, I've been reading up on this yellow jacket movement in France. I know that it's kind of hard to know exactly, from my perspective at least, I can't figure out exactly politically where a lot of these people stand. I feel like it's kind of a mismatch of different things, but it's really obvious that if you're watching what's happening, that the French state is reacting to what we would call violence in the streets in very real time. And it seems that it's pretty obvious that this discussion of tactics, of a diversity of tactics in approaching all of these struggles around the world, that having this conversation is more important than I think it's probably ever been. To sort of talk about that book first, you use those terms and you lay out in the beginning of the book how you're using the terms violent versus nonviolent. How would you define those terms in the context of this work?
Basically, that violence is an ambiguous term. It's a morally and politically loaded term. So I describe those features of the concept of violence, but refuse to define it specifically, because I don't think we should be basing our actions or our strategies on whether they meet the standard of this word, which is so easily manipulated, which is talked about so frequently by the media, by the police, by the state, in a way that that privileges or covers up their own actions, while putting our actions that we do to organize, to defend ourselves, to improve the quality of our lives, in a very scary, very negative light. And proceeding from there, I define nonviolence as a conceptual framework that tries to make some concept of violence central to how we understand our organizing, our struggles. But of course, holding up violence is a prohibition. So different proponents of nonviolence, different kinds of pacifists, will have completely different definitions of violence. For me, the most important feature is that they think that it's so important to use this moralistic and loaded word, and to prohibit people in social movements from doing whatever it is that they consider violent. So there is this authoritarian tendency that I identify within nonviolence to lump together all of the tactics that they don't agree with, and try to not just develop alternative paths of activity themselves, but to prohibit other people from using those tactics. And I think that's something that again also privileges the forms of harm that are carried out by the state, by capitalism, and so forth.
Right, and you cite some very like, some big historical examples you just that often pacifists or people that are proponents of nonviolent action that they use constantly to sort of point to oh, well, nonviolence is the most effective tactic. You know, you point to the anti-colonial movement in India, you know, with Gandhi, of course, a very, very famous example of that. You have the civil rights movement here in the United States from 1950s, 1960s into the 70s. You have the anti-war movement in that time period as well against the Vietnam War. You lay out why each of these movements have been historically whitewashed, that we don't have a clear understanding of what actually created change in these movements. I think a really potent example was the anti-colonial movement in India, you know, because I think people point at Gandhi all the time as being this, you know, exemplar of nonviolent action. Maybe we could use that as an example, if you wouldn't mind, to talk about why nonviolence really wasn't what led to what we think it led to, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. To sort of underline what I think is important is an important point. The book is not the book is not an apology or a call for violence. The book is a criticism of nonviolence, and as a part of that, it's a criticism of that entire dichotomy between violence and nonviolence. So, in all of these historical examples that you just brought up, it wasn't one pole or another pole of action that brought about the change. It was an entire complex interrelationship of actions of many different kinds. And unless we realize that it's those sort of uncontrollable, complex, and very, very heterogeneous movements that bring about profound change, then I don't think we'll be able to act intelligently within moments of social conflict. So, with the case of India, there it's no coincidence that Gandhi is the only person that we hear about in the history textbooks. That Gandhi is so famous. I mean, George Orwell said that the winners write the history books, and at the same time, proponents of nonviolence will always tell us that nonviolence is such a dangerous idea that the elites don't want us to learn the ways of nonviolence, which is so patently absurd, because in state-sponsored education, in corporate media, we're again and again told about how important Gandhi was. In the actual history, there were a lot of other formations that were equally or more important than Gandhi. There was the Indian National Congress, which for much of its struggle tended not to favor Gandhian methods. There was an entire network of armed anti-capitalists in late 19th century and early 20th century India. There was actually an international movement of Indians and Indian exiles who were very close to anarchism, who took part also in anarchist movements elsewhere, while also fighting for independence for India from British colonialism, like the Ghadar movement. That's something that's dealt with more extensively in Maya Ramnath's Decolonizing Anarchism, which is a very interesting book. There were moments, obviously, when Gandhi's protests were extremely important, but there were other moments when major riots were important. There were moments when the fact of this of these huge armed structures were more important, and really there was never a need for like this the sort of internecine competition between those different positions, with one exception, which I'm going to clarify in a moment. But there's this sort of like breach of solidarity that stems from the authoritarian impulse within nonviolence, that they have to claim absolute credit for any change that happens. They have to prohibit other people from using other tactics. And so they have to turn on systematically other people within the movement. That's something that Gandhi did repeatedly. And at times he lost a great deal of support in India for calling off the movement, or for canceling protest movements after confrontations that he didn't approve of cropped up. So I mentioned that there's an exception to this idea that in general we can use different tactics, we can use different methods, and still be in solidarity with one another. Those of us who might advocate sabotage or self-defense or combative tactics have absolutely no need to prohibit peaceful marches or acts of civil disobedience. We have no need to talk badly of the people who do those things. The way that they systematically deal with the actions that they don't approve of. Now, the exception to this is when you have a part of the movement that is authoritarian, that's trying to seek control. And we can see authoritarian currents both within the anti-colonial movement in India, as with any other movement anywhere else in the globe, that are authoritarian, that are just trying to take over state power, to put themselves in charge, to reap the benefits of some struggle. And you have currents that are anti-authoritarian, that are trying to decentralize power so that power becomes a collective process in which everyone takes part in shaping their own lives and shaping the world around them, rather than having to live according to somebody's plan of what a better government is or what a better society is. So really the only moment in which there isn't a possibility for solidarity despite difference or heterogeneous struggles is when a current of the struggle doesn't respect the basic legitimacy to exist of other currents in that struggle when they try to dominate the entire struggle. So basically authoritarianism is the only element that makes that kind of heterogeneous solidarity impossible. Authoritarianism can certainly be found in a number of armed or otherwise combative movements throughout history, but I argue that it's a systematic part of most iterations of nonviolence throughout the 20th and 21st centuries.
Mm. Yeah, it seems like whenever I'm thinking about how as you mentioned with Gandhi, it's like they kind of co-opted the movement a bit, and they say, they try to distance themselves from the more violent or what they would consider to be the more violent elements of a movement. But as soon as things move in their favor, they tend to take control of the power structure. So the state, right? They become the new state. And I think that we need to kind of remind ourselves that's a trend that happens over and over and over again. And so this is why I think your work is so important, because this is a trend. This is something we can see in historical accuracy over and over and over again. And we must, I was thinking about how people who don't want to engage in what they consider to be violent behavior when it comes to protest, and they would have qualms with anybody who is speaking on their behalf, who is using what they, again, would consider to be violent behavior, and how they would want to distance themselves from that. But do you think that there's often, within these more nonviolent segments, a more cynical element to that? Because I actually have sympathy for people who are like, I'm a pacifist, I don't want to hurt anybody, I don't want to even hurt the people that are oppressing me, I just want to use nonviolent tactics to get something done here. But there are others that are willing to engage in more direct confrontation with the state. And it seems like the people that you're talking about regarding the nonviolence, elements of nonviolence, is that they are willing to take advantage of the momentum generated by the diversity of tactics in order to gain power and control over others. Is that something you see kind of implicit in nonviolence itself, or is that something you see within particular groups of individuals that are using nonviolence as a platform to get into positions of power?
I think there are a great number of people within nonviolent movements who are committed to making the world a better place. They're committed to whatever cause that they're part of. They're sincere. Some of them have a personal preference to avoid certain types of situations or certain types of conflicts, and they try to extend that as a practice. Others have a certain ideology of do no harm, and maybe coming from like a more like radical Christian background or something else. I have nothing wrong with that. I have nothing against that per se, and I've had a number of friends from those movements. But those movements also tend to provide a platform that becomes very useful for what we could refer to as the politicians of the movement. The ones who want to win the role of the sort of respectful intermediary, the ones who will be quoted by the media, the ones who will get to negotiate with institutions of power. I mean, sometimes people launch their careers from nonviolent campaigns of civil disobedience and end up being politicians. There are other possibilities there. I would say that there's room for cynical or authoritarian people to take advantage of nonviolent platforms, without a doubt. But by no means would I say that every or even the majority of proponents of nonviolence do it for those cynical or self-interested reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, if I could use one more example, that's maybe a little, because I'm an American here in the United States, and I know that you originally, at least from what I understand, are from the United States as well. So maybe using an example that's a little more close to home, which would be probably the civil rights movement. Pretty big one, right? Because the most popular figure within the civil rights movement was Martin Luther King Jr. You know, you make this claim, which I think is actually really fascinating, and I agree with you, but I would like you to unpack it, that the civil rights movement really didn't meet its goal or its stated aims and goals that they had. I mean, what would you say were their stated aims or goals of the movement, and why would you say that they did not meet those ends?
I mean, I grew up white in the United States. I was taught in schools that the civil rights movement won, that racial equality was achieved, segregation was ended. So I wouldn't refer to this as my claim. It was the more that I got involved in movements against racism, against police brutality, against capitalism, that I came in contact with people from Black and Brown communities fighting against racism, fighting against continuing forms of segregation in the U.S. Of course, legal segregation was ended by the U.S. government in response to the civil rights movement. But if you take segregation on just about any other indicator, on economic indicators, access to education, things like that, in a lot of ways, it's gotten worse. I mean, nowadays, we can see what kind of people still deny that racism is a major problem in the United States. And if we talk to the veterans of that movement, or if we read the writings or read the testimonies of those who are no longer alive or those who are in prison, we can see that movement was, in their own words, about a lot more than just a couple laws on the books. It was about an entire white supremacist system and the effects that it has on everybody's lives. And that system hasn't gone away. So it seems a little bit insincere to claim a victory for the civil rights movement. I mean, absolutely, an important battle was won, but first and foremost, it's the United States government, it's the inheritor of these white supremacist systems that claims victory, because that's, of course, a very intelligent way to win a war, is to make your enemy go home. So if your enemy thinks that they've already won, then, I mean, especially if you're in charge of educating your enemy's children, I mean, it's a very cynical maneuver to sort of co-opt Martin Luther King and to claim victory there, precisely so that people stop fighting against the continuing forms of white supremacy. So the boycotts and the peaceful protests and all that were, of course, an extremely important part of the civil rights movement. But that's not what won the end to legal desegregation. I mean, in Birmingham, Martin Luther King was basically repeating the Albany campaign, which was a total failure. The tactics of civil disobedience didn't work there. All of the organizers ended up in jail without changing anything. The difference is that in Birmingham, the local youth started fighting back against the police. They didn't consider it dignified to just let themselves get beat up and jailed. And they didn't find it dignified to listen to these college-educated, out-of-town professional activists who were coming, telling them how they should resist. So they rose up, they fought back, they kicked the cops out of the center of Birmingham, they burned all of the white businesses, and just a few weeks later, Birmingham, which was the bastion of segregation in the South, which was supposedly never going to desegregate, they were desegregating, and the executive of the U.S. government was supporting the Civil Rights Act, when before they had kept telling Martin Luther King that now wasn't the time, et cetera, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it was not just the fear, but the reality of combative collective self-defense by black communities in the U.S., the very real and growing possibility of black uprisings in the U.S. that accomplished the partial victory represented by civil rights. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that this fits into this whitewashing of history, right? Because it's easier to go to school and have people taught that it was nonviolent protest that accomplished all of these things. What you just mentioned, I didn't know about that until I read it in your book. You know, I didn't know about that until maybe other historians that were tackling these subjects addressed those major events that tipped things in the activist's favor, at least temporarily. It's so when we talk about diversity of tactics, I think that's it's a blanket term to describe a lot of things. I remember when the Occupy movement was going on back in 2011, or I guess it was, there was a real debate, and I don't think all of the occupations were having this debate, but I know in Occupy Oakland, there may have been a more robust debate about this, but this idea that, sitting in a park all day and trying to not get arrested by the police isn't going to really do anything. You know, this movement needs to evolve. It needs to move in a different direction. We need to incorporate different tactics. And I remember that was really when the division... I feel like the division within the movement really became apparent, and then it kind of started to disintegrate after that point. So this argument that maybe nonviolent activists would have is that as soon as movements become violent, that is when we begin to see problems. That's when we begin to see more state repression. That's when we begin to see more divisions within the organizations themselves. What would you say to that?
I would say that in the U.S., the occupations that lasted the longest, that accomplished the most, and that engaged the most people were precisely those ones that used a diversity of tactics and didn't constrain themselves to nonviolence. I would also say that they have an extremely naive, reactionary view of the state. The state is not a passive set of institutions. It doesn't just sit there waiting for people to start misbehaving before punishing them. All modern states use a counterinsurgency philosophy with regard to their own populations. In other words, they view their own populations as a constant threat that they have to systematically and continuously surveil, discipline, and repress. Repression is an everyday activity. So Europe makes an interesting sort of laboratory or set of case studies, because you have a lot of countries right next to each other that are economically very similar, but with very different histories of their social movements and different political strategies used by their states. The countries in Europe with with the most repression, with the strongest police presence, with the most invasive police presence in the lives of the citizens, like the most social control, I would argue would be the UK, Germany, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and the some of these countries that have certainly had strong social movements in the past. But if you look at the years in which there's social peace, in which there's not a lot of conflict, there aren't strong social movements in those countries, state repression advances by leaps and bounds. Whereas if you look at the European countries where there are constant uprisings, constant resistance, people constantly fighting back, in those countries, more often than not, the states are less able to develop their repressive capacities, to increase their repressive capacities, because people just don't let them. So states don't just wait around until there's a revolutionary movement to start being repressive. We can also look at the color revolutions, which were these pacifist, very reformist, very pro-West, pro-US, and US-funded movements following the Gene Sharp template for peaceful regime change, which is basically the number one version of nonviolence today, like Gandhian nonviolence, nonviolence that was represented or developed in the U.S. civil rights movement. Those are not really present hardly anywhere on the world stage today. So if we talk about nonviolent movements today, they're almost exclusively using Gene Sharp's methodology. So we can look at the places where those movements stayed completely peaceful. The decision to use repression or not was a political decision. It was never a decision based on, is this movement violent? Is it not violent? Oh, shoot, this movement's not violent, so we just can't repress it. Tell it to the people in Belarus. Belarus, politically, didn't have as much to lose from repressing the movement because they have closer political and economic ties with Russia. They didn't need to curry favor with the European Union or NATO. They sent out the police, and that movement couldn't even stand up to police repression. The government didn't even have to send in the military. And they didn't suffer long-lasting consequences for that. So I mean, we can, just in the last 10 or 20 years, you can find all the examples you want of perfectly peaceful movements that were repressed by the state based on political considerations. And time and again, those nonviolent movements were completely unable to defend themselves from state repression.
Absolutely. So I find the what would be then, in your experience, you've been doing this for quite a long time, from what I understand, and you've really thought pretty deeply and written pretty extensively on this. So if you were to say, someone were listening to this and they were like, okay, I'm understanding what you're saying. I had a lot of assumptions that now I don't really believe in anymore. When you talk about the diversity of tactics, I mean, what would be something that has been effective in countering state repression? You know, if there's a movement that needs to start implementing these diversity of tactics, what would you say would be some of those tactics that would be effective for those movements?
It depends on the context, but yeah. Solidarity, sticking together, is always important. Ways of allowing and encouraging anonymity. One of the main things that the state has been doing, and constantly with the help of a lot of like the main technology corporations, has been removing any possibility for anonymity in social life. So there have been big battles about the legality or the legitimacy of masking up in protests, as just one example, or for example, rejecting some of these technologies that make it so that all of our movements and all of our communications are constantly traced and tracked. In a number of cases, governments, both the U.S. government and in Europe and other countries, have argued that if someone didn't have a cell phone, or if that someone had an encrypted email account or something like that, that in itself was an indication of terrorist and criminal activities. So it's very important to legitimize those sorts of practices that give us anonymity. It's really important to legitimize wearing a mask or otherwise hiding our identities in protests, or using the tools, the digital tools that will, I won't say give us security, but at least make us a little bit less surveilled. And that of course goes contrary to like this common argument that, you know, that we shouldn't be masking up in protests and whatnot. If there's one good thing about the rise in the extreme right in the United States in the last couple of years, it's that it's gotten rid of a lot of these completely naive ideas about social struggle. All of a sudden, people can see a very, very sensible reason for hiding your identity at a protest, now that you have Klansmen and neo-Nazis doxing people and visiting people's houses, attacking people. It's just unfortunate that people can see so clearly that a neo-Nazi or a Klansman is someone who obviously doesn't have their interest at heart, someone to protect themselves from, but they couldn't see that that the cops, that the FBI, were also other groups that didn't have their interest at heart and that they needed to protect themselves from. So that's one thing. Let's see. I mean, I think people can look into tactics that were used at Occupy Oakland to take over the streets, to hold the streets. There were a lot of really heavy street battles there and in other places. And there was obviously this learning process whereby people learned what kind of tactics are necessary to force the police back, to protect themselves from police in the moment of a protest or a riot in the streets. Over here in Catalonia, where I live now, a couple years ago, we had a pretty clear lesson of what it takes when the city evicted the Can Dia social center. This was a squatted social center in a context where more and more social centers are getting evicted, when the city is being turned over to tourists, and people are finally realizing that under capitalism, our homes don't belong to us. There's no right to home. And if someone can pay more, then you have to hit the street. And so in that context, people fought back. People started rioting. The first night, it was just a few hundred people that started it all. But contrary to the idea that scares people away, the next night, it was 10 times more. And the night after that, 10 times more, until you had tens of thousands of people in the streets supporting or directly participating in this very combative street protest, in which people kept the cops at bay with fire, with rocks, with whatever tools they had at hand, and ultimately defeated the police in the streets over a week of street fighting, and forced the city, which had a conservative government at that time, like a very like law and order, sort of a hard-assed anti-squatting government, forced them to cancel the eviction, even though it was really a done deal because people had already reoccupied the site of the social center. They had torched all of the demolition equipment the city was using to try to demolish that place. So those are just like two examples that people could look into of what kind of tactics have been working these last few years for occupying space and defending.
Right. Well, thank you for going over that. And
Actually, I'd also like to mention, sorry, one more quick thing.
Yeah.
Because the question is also about repression, which tends to take place over a much longer timeline than like the day or the week of street protests and riots. Of course, in the U.S., there was this huge case of repression after the G20 riots on Trump's inauguration. And it was just amazing that more than 100 people who didn't know each other from across the country, many of whom had never even been to a protest before, didn't snitch. That they supported each other at a basic level. They tried to work out a common trial strategy that respected everybody's needs. And they held together. A lot of other people supported them. They got resources together. And in the beginning, it was scary as all hell. People were facing decades of prison time. But because nobody snitched, because they stuck together, they got their charges dropped. They won. It was a huge victory for the movement, a huge embarrassment for the idiotic pro-fascist authoritarian prosecutor Kirchhoff and the other U.S. Prosecutors involved in that case. And so that is something also to look into. There's been a lot of good writing analyzing that victory. And I think equally people need to look into the repression post-Ferguson, post-Baltimore, the repression of water protectors at Standing Rock. Also, in large part, because there's been less support there. And so some people have been, a number of people have been going to prison around those uprisings or sites of resistance. And with those people in prison, they need support. That's also something that's a vital part of resistance. I mean, going to prison is much less scary if you know that there's going to be a lot of people who have your back and you're not going to be alone. And so being able to face that possibility bravely is an essential part of not caving, not breaking under oppression. So I think there's this, it's just important to underline that we have this collective responsibility to support the people who are going to prison after the uprisings in Ferguson, the other anti-police uprisings, and the resistance at Standing Rock. Mm.
Yeah, I think that we have a lot of contemporary examples and that people can learn from those. And, you know, I've been looking at this movement in France. I know that you're obviously much closer to it than I am. I have a few people that I'm looking to interview that are living in France right now about the movement there. Maybe if you wanted to comment on maybe what your views are of what's going on there, because from what I understand, there's quite a few different political elements, people who are maybe anti-fascists or anti-capitalist, but you've also got, you know, nationalists, you've got far-right elements of the movement as well, and you also got a lot of people that are just somewhere in the middle who maybe don't affiliate with any of those sides. But it seems to me that the rioting that we're seeing there is causing the French state to react in a very it's sort of obvious who's at fault in this situation. I think it's kind of showing the world what's really going on in France, that there's this veneer of civility that's sort of been ripped off. But if you just had some comments on what's going on there, if you had any opinions about what is happening there right now.
I actually don't think there's anything terribly interesting or intelligent I could say. I don't speak French, so most of my news about it has been from reading probably the same articles that you're reading. If there's anything that you've read that you consider really interesting, you should probably recommend that, but I don't think I'll...
Yeah, no, that's okay. That's okay. I just was wondering if you had any insights into that. I would then like to move on to your more recent book, which, you know, Worshipping Power, an Anarchist View of Early State Formation. And, you know, as you point out often, and I've seen you do some talks about this book, that you're not a professor, you're not a scholar in the academic sense, but that's kind of what gives your book a little bit more of a fresh take on this subject, I think, because you're not weighed down by the kind of, I'm trying to think of the right word here, there's almost a... I think that oftentimes people that are in academia are defending the legitimacy of the state, and that when they want to examine where state formation began, they often point to a singular event, or there's sort of a deterministic, like environmental determinism, as you discuss in that, that there's all of these, that if all the conditions are right, that states are just going to naturally form as a part of human progress, right? That we're just, if a society is sophisticated enough, it's going to develop into some sort of state structure at some point. And in your book, you kind of contend that. You argue that while a lot of these are factors in it, it isn't just one thing, and that is often, again, it's a lot more complex than what I think even the most well-researched work into it would often give us. So, you know, in that vein, in talking about that book, I mean, what are some of the common theories that you address in your book regarding state formation, and maybe kind of explain why you think that they're inadequate in providing us an explanation as to why this has happened?
Maybe some of the most common theories within anti-capitalist movements would be maybe materialist theories, more Marxist-influenced theories that see the state as sort of an adjunct or a consequence of economic stratification in the society. Looking at the relationship between the strategies and actions of nascent economic elites in a society and political elites, when they're the same actors, when they're not the same actors, looking at the economic limitations and the economic possibilities of ruling classes is certainly interesting. That provides a lot of material, and there's a lot of I think there are a lot of theoretical tools within that approach that can be useful. But as an explanation for state formation, it just doesn't work. Political stratification across the board tends to precede economic stratification, which I think is common sense. You can't really have rich and poor unless the rich have some kind of institutionalizing force that allows them to protect their wealth and also allows them to conquer the territory in which exploitation can take place. And maybe even more importantly, it creates a spiritual system in which that makes sense, in which it could be acceptable or even conceivable to own things. Because that's a very peculiar idea in human history, this idea that something can belong to one person and not to another, the idea that the planet or the land or other living things exist for our exploitation and for our enrichment. Those are very peculiar spiritual ideas that only came about with hundreds, if not thousands, of years of development of certain hierarchical religious complexes. So there's a materialist explanation for state formation, and materialist theories tend to give us more to work with when we look at how the modern states developed. And they tend, I think, to fall flat the farther away we get from Europe between the 15 and 1900s. Let's see, there's primitivist theories that connect state formation with domestication, with sedentary living. Again, there's that there's some useful ideas there, but there are just too many examples of horizontal anti-authoritarian societies that were sedentary, that lived in small cities even, that practiced agriculture, and really just too much time went by between the development of agriculture and the appearance of sedentary societies and the development of the state. Thousands of years went by, and I think it's just kind of sloppy theoretically to gloss that over. Now, I mean, there are perfectly valid arguments against sedentary living, against agriculture. Like, a primitivist doesn't have to oppose sedentary living or agriculture only because it leads to the state. I mean, certainly most human societies suffered a decline in health or started engaging in deforestation when they took on some of these practices. Although those don't have to be inevitable. You can find examples to the contrary.
Yeah, I've read some primitivists and their whole, like, where does the root of our of hierarchy or the root of our oppression, you know, come from. And, you know, they try to, like, I'm thinking of, like, say, John Zerzan or something, and I've had a conversation with him. But, you know, it's sort of interesting because I think that we often, even the most, I would say the most quote radical of thinkers can often fall into this trap that there's this sort of linear progression that, agriculture somehow, for whatever reason, people started to cultivate crops. They started to cultivate certain plants and vegetation that benefited them. And then that sort of eventually evolved into, sedentary life. And then, the city or the state emerged out of that and patriarchy, how private property comes into that. It's really hard to sort of pinpoint how all of those things began or developed into what they are now, but often we like to attribute all this to a very linear progression that even if it happened over the course of thousands of years, we can kind of trace that trend. But, as you say, that there are agricultural societies, there are city-state, or, what you say, cities that practice anti-authoritarian forms of social organizing. What examples are you looking at when you point to that? What are some specific examples that we have that show that that's possible?
Let's see. In the Mediterranean region, you have the Cretan civilization before it was taken over by the patriarchal and state-forming Mycenaeans. And you have the, I'm actually not sure how to pronounce this, it's a Romanian word, I think, or a place name, Cucinelli civilization, which formed in the area of what's roughly present-day Romania. Also another matrifocal, non-patriarchal, non-authoritarian society with relatively large population density. If you look at the first three civilizations in human history, the Mesopotamian, the Egyptian, and the Harappan civilization or Indus River Valley civilization, the first two were almost certainly state forming. But the third one, pretty much all the evidence seems to suggest that this was a stateless society. Also, I don't think it's a coincidence, they were the ones with the best quality of life technologies, the best sewage and hygiene systems. The housing sizes were equal. There wasn't any visible stratification of wealth. There's no signs of militaries or warfare. But also, curiously enough, it seems that civilization, after a good many centuries, after a long run, was also abandoned by its inhabitants, maybe voluntarily. That's something that evidence exists of in other places of the world, where a society makes a civilization, they make like a city-based society, in which there's certainly more possibility, at the least, for stratification. And then they abandon. They choose to go back to how they were living before.
Hmm. That seems like, I think for many people, like that's very peculiar, because when we think about a society that meets some sort of ecological limits, right? Like we know, like the Mayans or the Aztecs or the Mesopotamians, or you can cite pretty much any civilization that we know of, any highly complex hierarchical societies that have ever existed, that they tend to meet some sort of ecological limits, right? They've extracted too many what we would call resources, right? They have maybe destroyed their fresh water, or there's something that happens that makes it incredibly difficult for them to live in that manner any longer. And then we associate that, well, then there was a collapse, right? The society fell into ruins and everybody had to sort of figure it out and put the pieces back together the best they could. But what you're arguing is that there are plenty of examples of, for whatever reason, states that weren't working for the people, and so the people just kind of walked away from that. That there isn't this, that there's almost a fluidity between these different social forms of social organizations. And that, to me, is what's so fascinating, that people could actually remember or know how to go back to a pre-civilizational or pre-state model of social organizing. That's what really trips me up, because I try to imagine me now, or anybody that I know now, being like, you know what, this isn't working for us. We're going to go back and try to live the way our ancestors lived. And, you know, we don't need the state. We don't need to rely. We're not going to pay taxes anymore. We're not going to rely on the police to protect our community. You know, all of that, right? Just to imagine that people would just go back to, a pre-civilizational state. It baffles me. And that's all I had to say on that. Yeah.
I would argue that you couldn't really refer to those as pre-civilizational or pre-state, because anything that comes after is going to be different. So there will be some form of collective memory about how things were before, but the more generations go by, it's always going to be preserved as myth, which doesn't mean that's not a testament to whether it's accurate or inaccurate. But it certainly isn't usually a detailed catalog of all of the knowledge forms that were lost with a shift to more hierarchical or massified societies. But in any case, states, they alter the landscape. They alter human psyche. They alter human society. So there's not really any possibility of going back, which again is like borrowing from this progressive timeline, which would be that there's like a forward and a backwards with social change. So post-state is a very common, it's a very frequent reality in human history. I think that's going to be the most important argument to make. Post-state is always going to be different from pre-state, but post-state exists. Many human societies have been post-state, and hopefully we'll all once again get the opportunity to be post-state, given that at the current moment, which is a very tiny blip in human history, state power is nearly universal. One other little interpretation that I wanted to dispute there, you talked about fluidity. I absolutely agree. There is a great deal of fluidity of people just deciding to walk away or change a grand social experiment. In the course of human history, there are so many examples of that, obviously much more than we're taught, because we're taught to think of history as this onward march that only goes in one direction, when that's an absolute fantasy and obviously a statist fantasy. But once a society crosses the state threshold, I would argue that a lot of fluidity is lost, which doesn't mean that states don't change. States are constantly changing. The societies that they latch onto, that they take over, are constantly changing. But I would argue that it's changed in accordance with a very different logic. And it's the logic of the sort of like a conservative or reactionary logic of changing to stay the same. In order to try to hold on to their power, in order to try to keep everything the same, they have to constantly change. They have to constantly strategize. They have to constantly fight perceived threats. So people many times have walked away from societies that were becoming more authoritarian or that were becoming too massified for their good. But once you have a state, people can no longer walk away. They either have to run away, which is very, very common in the history of states, and I'll explain that momentarily, or they have to fight back and destroy the state. One of the principal activities of early states is slave raiding. It's hunting people down, capturing them, moving them back to the capital city or to the center of state power and forcing them to work. Because once you have a state, you can't just walk away. Citizenship within a state or subjecthood under a state is not voluntary, and it's never been voluntary. States always go hand in hand with slavery of some kind, with forced obedience and forced subjugation of some kind. So in areas of the globe where there have been forests, where there have been mountains, where there have been swamps, where there have been more opaque zones where people can hide, then throughout the entire history of the state, people have run away, but they couldn't just walk away. They had to actively evade state power, and when state slave raiders came looking for them, they had to run even further into the mountains, or they had to fight back. So the state threshold really constitutes a sort of end of freedom in human experience, where our choices become limited to running and hiding or fighting back, that we really don't get a say anymore, like other human societies had, when there could be a sort of mass rebellion that occurred in a way, which actually, referring back to our earlier conversation, sort of mirrors the pacifist dream of how social change should happen, when everyone just says, you know what, no, we're not going to do this anymore. That actually was probably the primary model for revolution in non-state societies, when you had creeping hierarchies, when you had maybe growing forms of inequality or environmental destruction, more pollution, dirty water, more diseases, where people would just say, you know what, we're not going to do this anymore. And their would-be leaders were powerless to stop them. But once you have a state, that doesn't really work anymore. Something, a more robust countermeasure becomes needed.
Mm-hmm. So is this idea of rebelling against the state, it almost seems like that's the most rational action, considering what other societies are capable of being, right? Like, I feel like, let me just figure out how to frame this in an interesting way. You know, I feel like now there has been, and I'm kind of citing a couple people in particular that have become very popular, at least here in the United States, and I imagine in other parts of the world as well, but they want to buckle down on this idea that the hierarchies implicit in states, in capitalism, in, say, male dominance, that is a biological element, right? That really what we're doing when we build states, when we build civilizations, when we build these types of economic systems, that really we're just building something that comes implicit in the human experience, being a human being. Sorry, there's a lot of background noise. Okay, one second. Okay. It's gone away now. So basically what I was trying to say is that the argument as to why we have states and why we have societies in the fashion that we do is that there's a biological element to it, that this is something that is deeper than states. This is deeper than capitalism. This is something that is innate in the human being. And I've always felt that there was something a bit off about that, because as you point to, and I think many other anthropologists, people that are looking at it from maybe a very anthropological perspective, are examining all kinds of different forms of societies, and they're seeing that that human beings are actually quite diverse. We're capable of organizing ourselves in so many different ways. Would you say that the state is a natural function of human beings, and that we have to kind of counter it with certain, maybe kind of an egalitarianism that's almost, I remember hearing this term from some anthropologists describing a fierce egalitarianism, and they were studying hunter-gatherers, and these are these very nomadic tribes, and they had these mechanisms within their societies, within their cultures, to kind of de-emphasize the ability for certain individuals to gain leadership, right? So that they basically had these mechanisms in their societies to inhibit this desire that certain people might have to build hierarchies, to maintain control over other human beings. And I feel like I have this contention within myself whether human beings are more prone towards egalitarian social structures or towards more hierarchical social structures, and that if we're more prone to hierarchy, we still should desire egalitarianism, but we have to build maybe a societal or cultural mechanisms in order to inhibit that element of our nature. Does that make any sense? I feel like I just wondering if you had any insights into that.
Yeah. The argument that humans have a biological need or drive for the state makes about as much sense as an argument that humans have a biological need for the internet. It just doesn't make sense because the vast majority of human history, there's been no state. And also in recent history, there have been many stateless peoples. There are constantly moments in which state authority fails and people do just fine. So it's just can't really be taken seriously as an argument. It's it's like phrenology or all of these other scientific arguments, which really have one purpose. It's not to interpret any body of evidence because there is no evidence to support it. It's simply an attempt to justify hierarchies that exist within our society. Mm-hmm. It's also, I think, implicitly a white supremacist and colonialist argument, because if you look at that argument historically, you have the British Empire, the Spanish Crown, French Empire, the United States, all these other settler states, Australia, etc., going in and just unleashing this wave of genocide against any society that was different, killing them off or enslaving them. And then their scientists come along and say and claim some universal human nature or wipe out. They help to erase the memory of the ways of being of those other societies. You mention that maybe there's a need for cultural mechanisms to prevent hierarchy. Yes. I don't think there's any such thing as human nature. I think we can only talk about human capabilities or potentials. Humans have the capability of creating egalitarian horizontal societies, and humans have the capability of creating hierarchical, oppressive, exploitive societies. We have the whole range. We can paint in the entire palette. And ultimately, it's a collective question of what we want to do. Every single human society has cultural mechanisms that encourage certain behaviors and discourage other behaviors, every single one. So it only makes sense that a society that doesn't want to be ruled, a society that doesn't want to have masters and slaves, would develop cultural mechanisms that encourage egalitarianism, that encourage suspicion of leaders or people trying to accumulate power or resources. However, I also think it's safe to say that like when you talk about these anthropological theories of sort of like willfully egalitarian societies that get studied and end up in these lists of characteristics of stateless societies, I think it's safe to say that the vast majority of those societies are post-state societies. They're societies that already have had contact with states, either neighboring states that they've had to fight off and resist or run away from due to that age-old state activity of kidnapping people and forcing them to work and to obey. Or there are even societies that had a state and then got rid of that state in one way or another and learned and evolved and became smarter. So I wouldn't at all be surprised to find, and if we're going to talk about anthropological evidence and whatnot, it seems to be suggested that actually the most actively anti-authoritarian societies in human history have been post-state societies. These are societies that have wised up, that have learned, at least with regard to states, and so they've probably developed more cultural mechanisms to prevent the reemergence of a state. And that's exactly what we would have to do if we were ever able to overthrow the state and horizontally organize our own societies. We've all been trained in reproducing oppressive systems, reproducing hierarchies, whether by obeying or leading. Anyone who grows up in our society will have generations and generations of trauma to work through. It's not a change that can happen in just one generation. So we would have, without a doubt, a very urgent need to come up with cultural mechanisms that encourage healing, that encourage anti-authoritarian behaviors, and that discourage oppressive and exploitive behaviors. And these are mechanisms that you can see being developed in anti-authoritarian movements across the globe.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if I want to bring up or if you would feel comfortable talking about what we discussed over email about some issues you've seen within anarchism in where you're living now. But something I see, and this is something that disturbs me, and I can actually see why this would support the opposing view, which I presented to you about it being biological or inherent in human beings or whatever. But, you know, we see these anti-capitalist movements, and, you know, within these movements, if they're trying to be, you know, non-hierarchical in their social, in their organizing, there can still be these tendencies within individuals in those movements to be abusive, to be traumatizing, to basically embody some of the worst elements of the society or culture that they're supposedly trying to abolish. I think a lot of times it's really obvious. It's very on the nose. Like, okay, this person is extremely abusive. That's very obvious. But there's oftentimes, I think, and I can't speak from experience as personally, but I often feel that people almost subconsciously or without even realizing it are replicating ways of being that they really, I mean, on a maybe intellectual or on a political level, they're trying to abolish, and they're bringing that into the movement with them. And that's why I wanted to kind of bring up this idea of generating mechanisms to counter that, and whether you had any examples that you could point to of anti-capitalist movements and anarchist movements around the world, you know, in our time now, that have started to implement some of these mechanisms within their own movements. I mean, if you had any ideas or directions for people that are listening so that we can kind of get a framework of how to approach this, because like you said, we're traumatized. We're most people have traumas that's been passed down from generation to generation that it never gets addressed. And we end up replicating the same traumas into the future, into future generations. And I think there's a lot of work that has to be done on multiple levels in order to counter that. But at least in the practical, like organizing sense, how do people maybe develop these mechanisms in order to build that more beautiful world that we all believe and know is possible?
What you talk about is absolutely a very real problem. We don't become perfect just because we start identifying ourselves as anarchists or any other label. And of course, we're constantly reproducing behaviors and beliefs that we were brought up with. Usually at first uncritically, and then sometimes in the way that we respond and try not to, we often somehow reproduce the same paradigm through this sort of recreation of opposites. There's no easy answers there. And also it's not, I think often this is a place, where really you can only learn from experience, because of course, in general, when a group of people deals with a problem like this of abusive dynamics or different kinds of power dynamics or traumatizing behaviors, afterwards, you know, no one publishes something about what happened, because everyone has their own intensely personal interpretations, because there's harmful things in there that no one wants talked about beyond the dealt with it, and so on and so forth. So when there's a riot in the city and we beat the cops, then eventually a book, a documentary is going to come out about that, and we can learn a lot of how it went down, and we can learn from that. But when it comes to interpersonal harm, I think it's a lot more difficult than beating the cops. There's a lot more there to learn. And in general, people usually only learn that through experience. Talking about situations that we deal with around, there's a Capri Sun move now away from these kind of blueprints or models that we frequently saw ago, in which there was this proposal of like, this is how these situations have to be dealt with, and I think a lot of people saw that there's no one model that works for every situation, that actually patience, compassion, well-directed anger, and commitment are a lot more, and honesty and good communication are a lot more important than having the right model. But maybe that, you know, maybe that making that model was like a necessary step in terms of learning from it, and certainly in terms of getting over the social norm, which was just indifference. I mean, talking about things like gender violence, you know, obviously, for the past year, everybody's been talking about Me Too, but for decades now, anarchists, other anti-capitalists, and other kinds of radical feminists and queer and trans activists have been dealing with these problems, and there's no easy way about it. But for such a long time, like the dominant, overwhelming social response was just to not talk about those things, to not deal with it. I mean, there are a couple examples that don't exist anymore, but that maybe produce some interesting materials and some interesting experiences, like Philly's Pissed and Philly Stands Up. In the Kurdish struggle, which is of course a very different context, they're also dealing with ways to confront patriarchal social structures and norms. I think one of the most important things is patience and learning from experience, trying to pass on experiences, learn from other folks who have dealt with similar situations, and not have the expectation that there's going to be easy black and white solutions. But yeah, I mean, there are some good texts out there about this, but it's one of the hardest questions there is. But yeah, it helps to recognize that that all of us are socialized to reproduce patriarchal dynamics, that all white people, for example, are brought up with entitlement, forms of entitlement and privilege that we're not even aware of until we get some kind of reality check, or someone who's had different experiences, or who's had more experience, stops us, takes us aside,
right,
helps us see some of these things we haven't seen before.
Yeah, I think that there's probably a lot of resources out there, and again, it is completely contextual. You know, you mentioned the Kurdish people, the revolution in Rojava, and I know that they have are actively trying to restructure the relationship between men and women in a way that really benefits women, because we've had this patriarchal value system that's been replicated over and over and over again, and it's going to take time to kind of break those habits, to break those trends. So, Peter, I really thank you for the time that we've had today. I was really looking forward to speaking with you, and I really, really appreciate the work that you've put out, because I think it's extremely clarifying to read your books, to know that someone is, providing that critique that I think is especially becoming, I feel like as the crisis of capitalism unfolds, people are going to want to understand the best way to approach it, right? And I think that your work is really important in that understanding.
Thanks a lot for inviting me on your show, and thanks a lot for doing this. It's really important to have projects like this that can get different viewpoints out there.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a wonderful week, and as a psychedelic bard, Terrence McKenna said, take it easy, dude, but take it.